This week on the 21st, we'll be taking a look at sexual assault on college campuses in Illinois. We start today with students, especially at Northwestern University.
There's not one dominant narrative of how sexual violence happens. There's also not one dominant narrative of who a survivor is.
Also, constituents are slamming Republican congressmen across Illinois for not meeting with them, and some are protesting outside offices, like Champaign's Al Kurtz.
I think Rodney Davis is a coward.
Yes.
For not showing up to take care of his responsibility of his constituents in this district.
Today we hear from detractors in Champaign and Carbondale, and Politico's Natasha Kurecki weighs in on the situation with other lawmakers. We'll also bring in the latest in state politics with the Chicago Tribune's Monique Garcia and Reboot Illinois' Matt Dietrich. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Where's Rodney Davis? Where's Rodney Davis? Where's Rodney Davis?
I would hope that he would have the courage to at least come and hear from opposing viewpoints.
Well, he only thinks he represents the Republican. The people who voted for him, that's who he represents.
Rodney Davis is in lockstep with Trump. And it's my belief that he'd better start moving towards us.
Those were protesters last week outside Congressman Rodney Davis's Champaign office. Thanks to University of Illinois journalism students Elizabeth Jassen and Mike O'Neill for that audio. Those weren't the only protests. Last week, congressional recess is a time for Washington lawmakers to come home. But for Republican lawmakers across the country, it was also a time to feel some heat from constituents who oppose President Trump. Illinois was no different. There were charges from some that lawmakers here were dodging their constituents. Joining us on the line are two constituents in different districts who have been trying to meet with their congressmen. Ann Quackenbush lives in Champaign. Jill Adams lives in Macondo, which is about 20 minutes south of Carbondale. Ann, Jill, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi there.
Thank you.
And your representative is Republican Rodney Davis. We heard some protests that he had outside of his office. I don't know if you took part in those, but I know that you tried to connect with him with one of his teletown halls. So what happened?
Yeah, that's correct. Members of his district have been trying really hard to get a teletown hall with him for several weeks. And so he did schedule a teletown hall. We received word that it would be happening on a Wednesday, and he put out a note on Twitter and Facebook that it would be happening. He told us a couple of days ahead of time and said we needed to register online. And so I did that. I registered online. But when the time for the town hall came, I did not receive a phone call. It was supposed to start at 6, and I understand now that it did. But I didn't receive a call until about 6:30. So I was only online for about the last 10 minutes of the call.
So you were able to get on, but just for the end of it, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Okay. And how did it go, what you did hear?
I heard about three questions, and I know that the people who wanted to ask a question, they somehow indicated on their phone that they had a question to ask, and so they were kind of pre-screened. And what I noticed is that there wasn't any follow-up allowed with any of the questions, so I know that there were some things that I and talking to other people had questions about that he talked about during the call, but we weren't allowed to follow up with anything. Also, in addition to that, there was another congressperson who was part of the teletown hall, not a representative from Illinois at all, but someone else from, I think he was from Texas. And so actually a lot of the time that was spent answering questions was hearing from this other person and not Rodney Davis.
Oh, so it wasn't Rodney Davis who was talking. I should mention, we did reach out to Congressman Davis's office. We got an email statement in response just before the program. He said that they called 120,000 people, that 7,500 people participated, and that this is, quote, a small group that's focused in part on obstructing and opposing anything and everything the Trump administration does. And he called his statement says in part that Rodney Davis doesn't do, quote, grandstanding events.
Right, right. And he's mentioned that before, and I want to clarify that Rodney Davis was there for the call, but he had another person there in addition to him who was also responding to questions who, you know, were members of Rodney Davis's district and not this other individual. So
you didn't have a chance to ask your question, right, Ann?
I personally did not ask a question.
What did you want to ask him?
I wanted to know really some fact-based information about their plans, the Republican plans for the repeal of the ACA, and some specific information with, you know, what we can expect coming down the line. I know that he responded quite often with, he had some personal anecdotes with friends or family members, but at least from what I heard, I didn't hear any specific facts. Also, in talking about, you know, he's calling us the opposition and saying that we're trying to obstruct things, which, you know, we can't really obstruct much. We're voters, but we can't really get in the way of legislation. But what we can do is call our representatives, and I may not have voted for him, but I'm still a constituent in his district, and he should still listen to what I and others have to say, because he is the representative for the district, whether we voted for him or not.
And you didn't vote for him, just to be clear.
I did not.
That's Ann Quackenbush, one of Rodney Davis's constituents in Champaign. We're talking about this. The Illinois, there's a hashtag actually that's been created. Illinois 13 is watching for District 13, which is Rodney Davis's district. We have statements, by the way. We reached out to lots of lawmakers in Illinois. We're going to put the full statement online of everything that they said. So if you follow us on Twitter, we'll tweet that out and we'll put it on our website as well. I want to go to Jill Adams in Maconda, which is about 20 minutes south of Carbondale. Jill, you're a constituent of Congressman Mike Bost. How's it gone for you? We just heard how things went for Ann. Did you have a similar experience?
We have not been able to have a meeting with him. We've tried a number of times. I originally, I had collected a number of letters about the ACA that I delivered to Representative Bost's Carbondale office. And that was back in January. I think we had 170 letters. And we delivered those. And we, subsequent to that, I asked for a meeting with Representative Bost, a small group meeting, to discuss the ACA. And I received, I made that request on January 27th, and I asked that when he was next in district, if we could have that conversation. I was told his schedule was booked, and I let it drop, thinking he would probably have some kind of town hall, and I'd be able to go to that and pursue my questions.
And so eventually, eventually, did you actually go to his office to try to meet with him?
Yes. When it was clear he was not going to have an in-person town hall, he did have a tele-town hall. I was not aware of it. I have asked to get his newsletter. I follow him on Facebook, but I had no notice of the town hall in advance, so was not able to register for it. And so there were a number of us who wanted him to have a town hall. And so we decided that we would go to his office. We were not going in protest. We were going to speak to his staffers, and, you know, if we happened to find him there, that would be great. But we assembled down the street and walked quietly to his office. I mean, there was usual conversation.
Sure. How many of you were? You said you assembled.
I think there were probably maybe 30 people.
30. Oh, okay. So it was a big group. Okay. 30 people. Mm-hmm.
And we weren't carrying signs. We didn't want it to be a protest. And we reached the Hunter Building, which is a privately owned building in Carbondale where he has his office. And even before we got to knock on the door of his office, the owner of the building, or someone who I think represented himself as the owner, told us we were not allowed there. And we said, we're here to see our congressman. It's a, you know, our tax dollars pay for his office. We have a right to approach his office. And he said, no, you don't have a right to approach on private property. And he called the police on us.
Did you have a chance Did you have a chance to speak with any of his staff, Congressman Bost's staff?
One of his staff people did come out, and she had a register, and she asked us to put in our names and put in our addresses. And we lined up single file to do that. There was a counter kind of out in the hallway of the building before you got to Congressman Bost's office. So the roster was there, and we were there to sign up, but then the police came and told us we had to leave.
So you didn't have a chance?
They told us we could sign the roster outside. We could take it outside and sign it.
And did you do that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We did.
Okay. And Jill, can I ask both of you, both of you have mentioned ACA, and for you, is that the most important issue that you're trying to convey to Congressman Davis, that you don't want ACA to be, the Affordable Care Act to be repealed?
Yes, that's correct.
Jill, what about you?
I have a number of issues, but I think that it is appropriate to focus on one issue at a time, and the ACA is certainly an important issue. And that was one that some of us were focusing on, and I think that would have been what we would have asked about first. If there'd been a town hall, other issues would have come up. I think there were concerns about the Russia connections. I think there are concerns about Representative Bost recently voting to pull back the regulations about allowing coal mines to contaminate streams near the mines, and Representative Bost voted for the rescinding of that regulation. Mm-hmm. So I think there were a number of issues, and if there had been a town hall, a number of them would have been raised.
Mm-hmm. Jill, that's Jill Adams in Maconda. She's talking about her representative, Congressman Mike Boss. I want to thank Jill and Ann Quackenbush from Champaign, a constituent of Congressman Rodney Davis, for joining me. And Jill, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Sure.
Thank you.
I should mention, we have called and emailed Congressman Mike Boss' office and also did not get a response before airtime. We also reached out to the offices of Congressman Peter Roskam, Congressman Adam Kinzinger, and Congressman Darren LaHood. They've all given us statements. They're all on our website. But to talk about all of this now, all these other lawmakers, we're joined by Natasha Karecki. She's a senior reporter for Politico. She writes the Illinois Playbook. Hey, Natasha, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
As you were listening to that conversation with Ann and Jill, are you hearing this from people all over the state?
We're hearing some similar accounts, although I got to tell you that last little narrative there about a group of constituents being refused on congressional property and the police being called on them, I think that's a bit unbelievable.
Yeah, when she said that, I was actually, we were talking about this in the office this morning also. I didn't know if there were, what the legal issues were involved with that, of saying you can't visit a congressman's office being called by the police and asked to leave.
I think that's something that's going to come back and to bite him and become a larger issue. Of course, we're only hearing one side of the story. I know you've reached out, but on the surface, that's something that I think hurts Republicans' cause right now. I mean, to the extent that, you know, they're trying to argue across the country, not just in Illinois, that these are, you know, these town halls that these people are calling for are orchestrated by liberal activists, you know, perhaps that they're, you know, there are people that are getting, you know, paid out of district residents to pack these events. But, you know, one thing I'll point out is that last week Politico attended 9 Republican town hall events across the country. We had reporters go, like, kind of fan out. And the GOP lawmakers who personally faced these crowds told us they believed that they were legitimate crowds. That if Hillary Clinton had been elected president, people from the conservative end of the spectrum might be doing the same exact thing. And if you recall, you know, as the tides were turning years ago, you know, we had Tea Partiers packing town halls and, you know, having, you know, really big demonstrations. So, you know, to some extent, there is a very legitimate grassroots operation happening here. I'm not saying that, you know, every single one of these people, I can't vouch for them, but certainly there's something going on in this country right now.
Right, right. And just to be clear, Natasha, also what happened at Boss's office, it was the building owner who said that they called the police, not the congressional staff member. The congressional staff member did meet with them, but apparently it was the private owner of the building who said you're not supposed to be there and called the police on them. But just to make sure that we've got those facts straight. But as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about statements we got from Darren LaHood, from Adam Kinzinger, who said, look, we've been meeting with people. We believe in the right for people to protest. Our staff have met with them. But then it kind of runs the gamut from there to Congressman Roskam, who said, you know, there's just shouting matches and it's just people who are screaming the loudest. What do you think? What's your sense? As you were talking about sort of the whole idea of this being grassroots, what's your sense in Illinois of how many people are engaging now with Republican lawmakers on this issue?
But I will tell you that, you know, in Roskam in particular, here's someone who, whenever he's up for re-election, we kind of ignore his re-election because he's in such a safe district and, you know, he's a popular congressman. But here he had some 300 people recently show up outside his a meeting where he was. He was inside answering questions, but he didn't hold a live town hall, and people were demanding to be let inside. To some extent, it did sort of have a whiff of an organized, more, you know, professional type of protest. On the other hand, I will tell you that just organically, I hear from people, I see it on Facebook, people are really angry over this election. So there is a quite a legitimate segment of the population that just wants their voices to be heard. They want to hear what their how their lawmakers are going to respond in Congress. And look, we're in a blue state. And we have a very red president. So there is going to be a clash there. And I think that, you know, some of the takeaway that's been very interesting is hearing people like, you know, Gabby Giffords come up and saying, you know, look, listening to your constituents is the most basic core tenet of the job. And, you know, she was shot on a Saturday, and by Monday morning, her offices were open to the public. And we've heard a lot about these teletown halls, and it is a way to reach out to constituents. But as you also just displayed on your show, they're not perfect. You know, people have to rely on receiving a phone call rather than the other way around.
Nishasha, can I stop you for just a second there? We've just got to take a break. But when I come back, I just want to finish up this conversation with you about constituents across Illinois. We're talking with Politico's Natasha Kurecki. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about Illinois' congressional delegation during the recess, how they face their constituents at home. We were just talking to two folks, one in Champaign, one in Carbondale, about their attempts to get in touch with their Republican lawmakers. My guest on the line with me from Chicago, Natasha Kurecki, a senior reporter for Politico. She writes the Illinois Playbook every morning. Natasha, you were just talking about these teletown halls, and I wanted to ask you about that. Is this sort of a new thing, the idea that you dial into an electronic town hall? Is this something that has just come up in the past couple of months, or have these been around for a while?
These have been around for a while. You know, Peter Roskam, who's been really under the gun lately, he's been doing them for a long time. And I, you know, I interviewed him recently about it, and he said his reasoning for it is, look, my average constituent can't come out and attend a town hall, but lots of people, the 90%, are much more likely to listen to a phone call. If they put it on speaker while they're washing the dishes or getting their kids ready for bed, they find it much more amenable to their circumstances. So he believes it's a way to reach out to people in, you know, just to give an update. And he has been doing them for quite a while, I would say a couple of years at least.
And when we think about this, you were also talking about sort of the groundswell. And I'm just thinking in particular of the hashtag. There's a hashtag. There's a couple. There's Illinois 12 is watching. There's Illinois 13 is watching. We had our social media research team look into it. And it's since February 1st, there's been about more than 7,000 tweets using this hashtag. It's currently one of the most active political hashtags in Illinois. Do you have a sense of where this will go from here? Where you think, as we're looking at these different districts across the state, I think it's interesting when you look at Rodney Davis's district, obviously, Natasha, because it is a district in Champaign-Urbana that has very differing political views, maybe compared to other districts across the state outside of Chicago. Where do you see this going?
I see it. I see them kind of beating the same drum. It's getting a lot of attention. It's something that Democrats can kind of rally around. And it's something that, you know, if you're opposing the administration and some of the policies of the administration, this is something you can also get behind just as an average person. What I've seen a couple of these groups that you just referenced mention is that they're going to run opposition to in these, you know, in the next primaries or you know, general elections. You're going to see sort of these people who are who have not been challenged before, like Roskam, see some really solid opposition. And, you know, what's also interesting is in a couple of these districts, particularly Roskam, Hultgren to a certain extent, while these congressmen won their districts, Hillary Clinton won their districts. So those are ones that are getting really targeted by, you know, statewide and national organizations to try to see if they can turn it over in 2 years.
That's Natasha Karecki, a senior reporter for Politico. She writes the Illinois Playbook. You can subscribe to that every morning. Natasha, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Nyla Boodoo, this is the 21st. This week on the program, we're going to be taking an in-depth look at sexual assault on college campuses in Illinois, focusing on a different issue each day. Right now, we're going to be talking about this for the next 15 minutes or so. And to begin with, we wanted to start with Northwestern University in Evanston. Earlier this month, there were two reports of drugging and sexual assault involving two different fraternities. The news rocked the campus, compelling hundreds of students to stand up and call for the removal of one of the fraternities, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, where one of the alleged assaults occurred in January. One of those students is Amanda Odaz. She's a senior at Northwestern University and one of the co-organizers of the Stand With Survivors rally that took place earlier this month. She's on the line with us now from Evanston. Hi, Amanda. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What was your first thought when you first heard about the sexual assault charges?
When I first got the email about it, I believe it was on a Monday night when Northwestern had sent out that email. And because of my position on campus as a peer educator around sexual violence issues, I immediately thought about how I could jump into action. Unfortunately, I wasn't surprised by the reports. I think that I heard that sentiment echoed among a lot of other people that I talked to as well, that, you know, we really felt like this wasn't actually a surprise. It wasn't shocking to anyone that SAE was the fraternity where this report was coming out of.
Amanda, you said you're a peer educator. What does that mean?
That's correct. Yeah, so I've been a part of this group called Sexual Health and Assault Peer Educators since my freshman year at Northwestern. So when I joined this group, I went through 40 hours of training around sexual health, sexual violence, responding to and supporting survivors, providing resources. I'm a certified peer educator as well. So what it means is that our whole group on campus is there as people who are sources of information and support for other students and can connect them to resources.
That said, who had the idea to have a rally to bring this message to the broader Northwestern campus community?
So it actually started through Facebook. My friend Asha, who is another member of the exec board of SHAPE, she actually posted a status on Facebook that basically said, like this status if you're down to protest SAE. And from that, we ended up creating a secret Facebook group and ended up with about 350 people in that group. So people started posting in the Facebook group. It really just happened organically at that point of everyone posting ideas for what we could do. The idea came up to do a march on campus starting from the Sigma Alpha Epsilon house, which is on the north end of our campus, and then marching down south through our campus to the south end where the actual national headquarters of the SAE fraternity are. So that idea came up in the group, and then by the next day, we had a group of organizers who were meeting and starting to plan things out, and it all came together very, very quickly.
I know that at the rally, there were part of this was to give voice to survivors of sexual assault. What kind of stories were shared that day?
Yeah, there was a range of stories shared that day. A number of them certainly were students who unfortunately had experienced sexual violence at Northwestern. There were also some students who hadn't. But I think we really saw a range of different stories about sexual assault there. And I think that was important for people to see that there's not one dominant narrative about how sexual violence happens. In many cases, the students who spoke were talking about situations where they knew their assailant. That's very common, that people will know their perpetrator. We also had students who had experienced things before coming to Northwestern, people who had been survivors multiple times, so had survived multiple sexual assaults. We had both men and women speaking.
it was a range of things, and I think that that was important for people to see as well, that it's not one dominant narrative.
And what message did you hope to convey at this, especially now that I feel like it's been a week or two since you had this rally? What impact has it had on the campus?
So first off, we wanted to just make sure that everyone was aware of this issue and make SAE nationally aware that students on Northwestern's campus are watching right now and are really upset about this and do really care about what has happened. A big part of this is holding our institutions accountable. So both SAE as a fraternity, that's why we were there right outside their national headquarters, but then also holding Northwestern University accountable and holding our other students accountable. So that was the first step, is to just bring this information out there and say, hey, there's hundreds of us here who care about this and who are watching and who want to see Northwestern do the right thing in this situation. And then we're also out there to show survivors that there are people on this campus who really care about them and who want them to feel safe and who want to do everything that we can to support them.
Now, I know that there's been news reports that, and we know that you've mentioned SAE, the national headquarters has confirmed that they've suspended all activity for the campus chapter until this investigation is completed. I know that Northwestern has said all social activities for all campus fraternities have been suspended. Do you feel like the university is doing enough, like in terms of how it's reacted to these most recent incidents?
I think they're saying the right things, which is a step in the right direction. I don't know if I can really speak to the action that's being taken, and I think that's what's frustrating for a lot of students at this point, is that we're seeing Northwestern sending out an email or making a statement where they're saying the right things, but we don't know what's happening behind closed doors. We don't know what, if any, oversight actually is being put into place right now in those fraternities. One of the things, we put together a petition, and one of the things that we are requesting actually is nightly checks of the SAE house right now while they are suspended, so that there's actually more oversight there. But yeah, I think that's what's frustrating for us at this point, is just not actually knowing what's happening behind closed doors.
Amanda, I think what's frustrating to a lot of people who are listening to this is seeming like we have this conversation every year. We hear these reports every year. This is a conversation that we've been having, unfortunately, for decades. What do you think it will take to change the culture on campuses to bring about real change to prevent sexual violence from happening?
I think we need broad-based institutional change. I think that we have to look beyond surface-level education programs. Education is certainly a part of that. You know, I say that as a peer educator, where I spend a ton of time talking to students about sexual violence, and I do think that that education is really important. It's important to have those conversations. But we also need to do more in changing the way that our institution functions, so that we are making clear at Northwestern that we're a campus that is supportive of survivors and does not tolerate sexual violence. That means we need to expand resources for survivors, especially expanding trauma-informed counseling options. It also means that we need to change the way, I think, that we address policies about Greek life specifically, and especially related to alcohol. I think that at the end of the day, what's just so important to realize again is that there's not one dominant narrative of how this happens or how sexual violence happens. There's also not one dominant narrative of who a survivor is. We know that the majority of survivors are women, but that's certainly not all of them. We had male survivors who spoke at our rally a couple weeks ago. I personally know male survivors, and I want to make sure that we're affirming all of those stories and different experiences that people have, because, you know, every one of them is valid.
Amanda Odez is a senior at Northwestern University, co-organizer, one of the co-organizers of the Stand With Survivors rally that we've been talking about. She's also the outreach chair. She's been telling us about SHAPE, Sexual Health and Assault Peer Educators. Amanda, thanks for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thanks so much.
We did reach out to SAE National Headquarters, and they sent us a statement confirming that the chapter has been placed under a cease and desist order. And they also said that any form of assault or sexual misconduct by anyone, brother or not, college man or not, is completely unacceptable. From Northwestern University in Evanston, we go now to the University of Illinois campus, where just this month there were three reports of sexual assault, two of those incidents at unnamed fraternity houses, the third allegedly at a residence hall. In studio with me is Rachel Storm. She's assistant director of the Women's Resource Center at the University of Illinois. Rachel, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So when I say three incidents just in the month of February, that seems like a lot to me. Has there been more reports this year compared to previous years?
What we've seen is more reporting overall. So that's a really important thing because it also speaks to the heightened awareness of both this issue as a problematic issue, but also of the resources that are available. So when a report is made, that's a report through what we call the Clery Act. And that's also not all of the reports. Those are just the reports through Clery Act. So the Women's Center serves a lot of students. And it's important to recognize that the Women's Center is also a confidential service. So I can't usually speak to specific cases or the amount, but I can say that it's really important that we're seeing more reporting because it means that more people are getting to resources. Our suspicion is that there aren't actually more sexual assaults or that the statistic is going up, but rather that we're seeing more people reaching out for help.
And what about, to Amanda's point, her frustration of saying she doesn't know, in the case of Northwestern University, how the university's handling it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very important that university administration and units reach out and do share as much as they can about what the university is doing to address things like campus sexual assault. We recently worked with the university police department here locally to produce a blog post that did talk a little bit about the different measures that the Women's Center and all of our other units at the University of Illinois do to address this issue. But some of the reason why there is often omissions in reports or less information is
less communication,
period. Some of that information is not necessarily reported. And also some of that information isn't shared publicly because it will potentially threaten the survivor for that to be public. So we do
everything. Also, this is part of this illegal process as well. So there's just a lot of things that information that
Absolutely.
Universities don't want to share because it's an ongoing legal process.
Well, and what we do is we talk about how a lot of these kinds of violences, gender-based violence, is an issue of power and control. And so the most important thing that we can do is make sure that student survivors are in the driver's seat about what happens next. And so our center is a confidential center where we aren't mandated reporters, where we can hear from a student about what they've experienced and talk to them a lot about their resources and what's their options, what's available to them, without those pressures, so that reporting happens on their time and that it's their decision and their informed about what's happening next.
We also heard Amanda talk about trauma-based counseling. Does that happen at the University of Illinois?
So what we do at the Women's Resources Center is not therapeutic counseling. So we work very collaboratively with the Counseling Center, McKinley Health Center, Disability Resources and Educational Services Center on campus, all of which are also confidential services. And they often provide more therapeutic counseling with psychologists, psychiatrists, etc. One of the things that's important to recognize is that the Women's Resources Center offers options-based counseling. And we talk about, and what we use is what we call a survivor-centered approach or a feminist approach to direct service, which means exactly as I said before, that the focus is on making sure that that student is aware of all of their rights and options as much as possible so that they are empowered to take the next step of what they'd like to see happen. And what we often do see is that students are coming to us because they're not sure if they want to report. And then what ends up happening is they get to hear about the reporting process and about how we can serve as an advocate for them through that process, and the likelihood that they will report actually increases after visiting with us.
That's Rachel Storm. She's assistant director of the Women's Resource Center at the University of Illinois. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about sexual harassment in the sciences, focusing on what happens when the harasser is a professor. I want to throw the number out there for everyone who might be listening. The National Sexual Assault Hotline number, if you need help, that number is 1-800-656-4673. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is The 21st. Thanks for listening. As we approach 2 years without a state budget, the state Senate meets tomorrow to continue working on a bipartisan budget plan. The largest state employee union in Illinois has authorized a strike, and Governor Rauner is planning on meeting with Chance the Rapper this week. Those are a few news headlines we're talking about with two reporters who cover state government and politics. Monique Garcia is with the Chicago Tribune. She's on the line from Chicago. On the line from Springfield, Matt Dietrich, editor of Reboot Illinois. Monique, Matt, welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you.
Good to be here. Thanks, Nyla.
Let's start with the Senate meeting tomorrow in Springfield. Matt, what's the latest on negotiations for a bipartisan budget plan?
Well, this so-called grand bargain, as they're calling it, has been in play since early January when the leaders of the Illinois Senate first introduced it. It's a package of 13 bills, and they pertain to things like new taxes, raising the income tax, changing the sales tax. It also has some of the reforms that Bruce Rauner has been after, at least in the topics that he's been after, workers' compensation, a property tax freeze, things like that. The problem that it's having now is that it's been struggling to find compromise between, it was introduced by the Republican and Democratic leaders of the Senate, but now you have Governor Rauner has stepped in and kind of indicated that he's not going to support at least the property tax portion of it. They're talking about a two-year property tax freeze. He wants it permanent. And the biggest hurdle right now is time. And Senate Republican leader Christine Rodogno had said recently that if they couldn't get this thing passed by February 28th, that it probably wasn't going to pass at all. And the reason for that is Illinois is now racking up billions of dollars in back bills. It needs to get those paid, and therefore in this plan there is an income tax increase that's supposed to be retroactive to January 1st of this year. Will you get much farther away from February 28th, you're getting too far out to go back and, you know, take all that withholding tax out of people's paychecks.
Oh, right, because it's too big of a, right, that makes sense. You know, Monique,
right.
Matt mentioned Governor Rauner. He was actually in Washington yesterday. He was there for Republican Governors Association meetings. There was actually lots of bipartisan meetings with governors, but Governor Rauner didn't attend those, nor did he attend the Trump all on Sunday at the White House. Is that correct?
Right. Last night when the Oscars were going on, Donald Trump was hosting a black tie ball with about 46 governors from both parties. And Governor Rauner was noticeably absent. And this continues a trend we've seen with the governor over the last year or so, where he's done his best to kind of divorce himself from Donald Trump. This was, of course, when Donald Trump was running. He was a very controversial Republican candidate. And the governor, who is up for re-election again, has been very wary to link himself very directly with the now president. That's because Illinois overwhelmingly went for Democrat Hillary Clinton. And Republicans in the state, particularly in the suburbs, tend to be a little bit more moderate. So he doesn't want to be seen as embracing some of the more controversial aspects and policies that the president has been touting, but he also doesn't want to be seen as speaking ill of him either. Donald Trump did do very well downstate Illinois and some southern counties, and the governor is very much aware of kind of this fine line that he has to walk.
You know, the governor's also office says there's been lots of reports in the past couple of weeks, especially after the budget address, where's Governor Rauner? They've, in some of the responses, they've pointed out that he spends about half of his time in Springfield, 55% of his nights. This is something that often comes up around campaign time. Why is that important, Monique?
I think that it's important, particularly downstate, because people want to see their governor as being involved and being at the Capitol, particularly so when we've been locked in the last 2 years of battle over a budget, where, you know, I think last week it was the governor was skiing for his 61st birthday in Utah, and you'd see people kind of snickering on Twitter like, oh, he has time to hit the slopes. Why isn't he working on a budget? It opens him up to criticism, fairly or unfairly, that he's not there and he's not here and he's not really helping direct some of these negotiations.
Some of the negotiations, Matt, include the ongoing issues, contract negotiations with AFSCME, the largest state employee union. Late last week, they voted to authorize a strike. How unprecedented is that? And I point out, of course, Matt, the significance of just authorizing a strike vote, not that they're actually striking.
Sure. It's completely unprecedented. There has never been a vote like this to authorize a strike. There's never been a state employee strike, but it's never even come to the point of putting it before union members whether or not they would authorize a strike. Now, whether or not they actually walk off the job is a whole other question, and there are a lot of other hurdles to come. And that vote last week really took the tension between the Rauner administration and AFSCME to a new level. And this is something that I think, to appreciate the kind of the historic nature of it, you really have to understand the backstory. This is a union that Rauner has referred to in the past publicly as AFSCME. And even before he was governor, if you go back and search online, you can find some editorials, some op-eds that he wrote in the Chicago Tribune that were extremely critical of public employee unions. So as soon as Rauner came into office, you had him coming into office with this history of, you know, being very opposed to public employee unions, which he says are corrupt by their nature, because he says they negotiate with the very people that they can then turn around and endorse. And conversely, you had AFSCME being, you know, really getting their guard up, because he came into office 2 years ago when their contract was about to expire, and they knew they'd have to be negotiating a new contract with them. So I always saw what happened last week as inevitable. Now, whether or not it results in a strike and, you know, the consequences of that, I don't know where it's going from here. Would workers actually go out on strike? Would they risk being locked out and
Monique, you want to weigh in on this? Unprecedented, but how much of this authorization vote was also about leverage?
Well, this is all about leverage. This whole thing has been basically a giant kind of negotiation strategy. And you have a governor who made his many millions driving a tough bargain in the business world. So he views this as continuing to drive a tough bargain and hoping that eventually the union will blink, knowing that this can be very disruptive to members. His chief bargaining officer has pointed out numerous times that a strike would be detrimental to workers, that they wouldn't have health care, they wouldn't be getting paid regularly, they wouldn't be having money contributed to their pensions, their retirement fund. And they've tried to stress over and over again that this will hurt you, an individual, more than it will ever hurt, you know, the larger kind of political organization that the union represents.
And what would it take before we got to workers walking off the job?
Well, I think that that's the open question. The union has said that they want to kind of exhaust every other opportunity, and that main course right now seems to be in the courts. The union has filed a suit to try to block this ruling from the labor board that there is even an impasse. Right now, there's a temporary stay on that case, which means that the governor's been unable to enforce his final best terms, and the union has asked for a fuller, more permanent stay while that underlying case moves forward. It's in the appellate court in Sangamon County right now, and so we're really kind of just waiting to see what the court does, which I think will kind of determine then how the union proceeds.
I want to ask both.
And
go ahead,
Nyla,
Matt. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, we should also point out that the reason the union took this vote now is because the stay for a little more backstory, back in November, the Illinois Labor Relations Board ruled in Governor Rauner's favor and said, yes, talks are at impasse. Normally, that ruling would allow the governor to impose his last best offer onto the union. The union went to court and got this stay, but it's only a temporary stay, and they say that they took this vote last week because they know that at any moment this temporary stay could be lifted. Then Rauner's going to try to impose his contract terms on them. They want to be ready in case that happens. But like as Monique said, though, they're also in court trying to get this temporary stay made to go along with their appellate case. So as long as the appellate court is hearing it, which could be months or longer, then Rauner would never be able to impose the contract that he says is his last best final offer onto them.
Two quick things I want to get to you guys before we go. Monique, really quickly, I know there were dueling rallies over the weekend in Springfield about a bill in the State House to create sanctuary zones for immigrants who may be here illegally. What's going on with that?
Well, I think that this is a larger kind of trend we've seen at the Capitol, where Democrats who control the General Assembly here have been responding a lot to policies coming out of the Trump White House. They really want to signal that we're a democratic state and we're welcoming. So this bill in particular that's being considered creates these kind of safe spaces, which basically would prevent law enforcement officers from going in and enforcing immigration laws at schools, medical centers, healthcare facilities, even churches, unless they have a court-issued warrant. There's still kind of, you know, a long way to go before this thing becomes law, but there were opponents this weekend who held some rallies outside of the Capitol saying, you know, we don't support this plan, and raising questions about, you know, how much this would cost, specifically because President Trump has said that towns and cities and states who don't follow his enforcement guidelines on immigration could stand to lose millions of dollars in federal funds.
Yeah. Lastly, completely changing topic, one quick question for you, Monique. Governor Rauner mentioned in passing he's going to be meeting with Chance the Rapper. How did that come about?
That's right. So the governor was out last week at a Black History event in Chicago and mentioned that this week he'll be meeting with Chance. Chance, of course, won a couple of Grammy Awards earlier this year, and they had kind of started tweeting back and forth at each other. Either the governor or the person who controls his account said congratulations to Chance via Twitter, and Chance tweeted back, hey, thanks, I'd really like to get a chance to meet you. And this is notable because Chance has been pretty outspoken about some issues dealing with the governor. Last year, he took to Twitter to complain about the governor vetoing a bill that would provide funding for low-income scholarships for students, commonly known as MAP grants. And he's also been very outspoken about Chicago violence. So it'd be kind of interesting to hear, you know, what they have to say to each other.
Yeah, we'll have to hear about that. Well, that's Monique Garcia, State House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. I want to thank also Matt Dietrich from Reboot, Illinois. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nyla.
All right, that's a little chance for you there. And he may have a contender, actually, for new Chicago celebrity status. Last night's Oscars ceremony featured a new Chicago celebrity, an unsuspecting tourist who became part of a bit done by host Jimmy Kimmel. Gary Allen Cole from Chicago became an instant celebrity when he and his fiancée, who were visiting L.A., had their tour bus diverted to walk into the middle of the Oscar ceremony. Aiming his bright purple phone case at the crowd, Gary walked into the room leading the group.
Hold on. You are... I see Gary's your name?
My name is Gary Allen Cole from Chicago.
Where are you from? Oh,
yes,
you're from Chicago.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You know we're on TV, so you don't need
to
do that.
I know, but I want to.
Let me give you a little tour. This is Nicole Kidman.
Hi, Nicole.
It's Octavia. This is Ryan Gosling. He's very handsome. Don't look into his eyes. Oh, that's nice, Ryan. Yes. We have quite a few stars. Here's this Emma Stone and her brother, Spencer. I feel like you're ignoring the white celebrities.
Yes, I am, though.
Gary was an instant hit, not just with the audience inside the Dolby Theater, but everyone on social media who created the hashtag Gary from Chicago within minutes. They were tweeting about his instant acknowledgement of being from Chicago, his gray shorts, his Hollywood souvenir sweater, and the woman's purse he was holding, which turned out to be his fiancée's.
Gary, is this your wife over here?
Yeah.
What's your name?
Vicky Mines.
Hi, Vicky. Are you here with Gary?
That's my fiancée.
Well, oh, really? When are you getting married?
July 18th.
Who's your favorite actor?
That man right there.
Denzel? Denzel, would you be the best man at their wedding?
From asking Mahershala Ali to take his picture while he held Ali's Oscar to being fake married by Denzel Washington, Gary did not leave the 89th Academy Awards ceremony unnoticed. Within minutes, the Chicago Bulls offered him free tickets. And of course, word just within the past hour that Gary and Vicky are going to be on Jimmy Kimmel's show tonight. So a fun moment from last night's Oscars. Of course, Moonlight winning the best picture with lots of drama, but a win for Terrell Alvin McCraney, Steppenwolf in Residence guy there. So nice win for Illinois all around. That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Just tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information about us. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.